Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Passport to Shame, From Asian Immigrant to American Addict, by Sam Louie, M.A.L.M.H.C. Narrated by David Lee Huynh. Introduction. So ashamed that the ancestors of eight generations can even feel it. Chinese proverb. Asian cultures are rooted in shame. They are known as shame-based societies because the lives, families, and mindsets of these cultures revolve around some aspect of avoiding shame to preserve familial and cultural honor. In Chinese culture alone, there are more than 100 different ways to describe shame. While some of them overlap with English versions of shame, such as a sense of disgrace and humiliation, many others help shed light on why and how shame is so pertinent among Asian cultures. Within the Chinese, some of the shame-related terms and references are a nation's humiliation/shame, i.e., bringing shame to yourself also brings shame to your family, ancestors and community, and your entire ethnic background and/or family's country of origin. The old father-in-law carries the young daughter-in-law on his back to cross a river. In Chinese culture, it is considered inappropriate for a father-in-law to have physical contact with his daughter-in-law, thus equating how taboo it is to be associated with shame. And a person lives by face as much as a tree lives by bark, and as much as a light bulb is covered with glass, i.e., stressing the importance of maintaining a positive and good-standing public image. To encourage conformity, shame is built into child-rearing practices. Asian children are shamed early on as a means of guiding social and moral behaviors. In addition to collectivism, religions and philosophies such as Buddhism and Confucianism perpetuate shame, as they value filial piety, obedience, authority, ancestral worship, and loyalty to family. In other words, to let others down simply by deviating from social or family norms or engaging in behaviors that can be seen as shameful is much more negatively impactful to Asians than Westerners. In Asian culture, shame often begins early. Basic human needs such as touching, relationships, and affirmation can be thwarted during this time. When primary caregivers do not display physical signs of affection like hugs or kisses, verbal affirmation such as words of encouragement, or take the time to know their children individually. These children may develop internal core messages. I'm not good enough. I'm not lovable. I'm a bad person. Shame is powerful. Children and adults will do anything to thwart those feelings. Some become perfectionists or try to prove their worth through academics, sports, or careers. Others may become susceptible to addictions, seeking to fill their core emotional needs in unhealthy ways, drugs, alcohol, food, gambling, shopping, work, sex, etc. Unlike the United States and other Western countries, which pride themselves on individualism, equality, and autonomy, traditional Asian nations exalt collectivism, hierarchy, and obedience. As a result, Asian societies are often referred to as shame-based cultures, in which social order is maintained through the use of shame. Identities are forged by upholding honor while avoiding any shame-producing feelings, thoughts, beliefs, or behaviors. This presents a cultural bind where the shame leads those to suffer in silence, since acknowledgement can be met with family, community, and cultural rejection, ostracism, or banishment. I should know. My life was once shackled by shame. As a first-generation Chinese immigrant to the United States, I was challenged by shame from the moment I arrived on these shores. The shame of being Asian in America. The shame of prejudice and racism. The shame of Asian masculinity. The shame of breaking away from Asian norms. And eventually, the shame of my addiction. Not just my addiction, but a family legacy of addiction. I come from at least three generations of addicts. My grandparents were compulsive gamblers. My uncles and aunts also gamble. Some of my relatives struggled with infidelity. My parents were workaholics. My brothers struggled with their own compulsive and addictive tendencies. And I inherited a combination of addictions, in addition to carrying the burden to be the first in my lineage to succeed in America. The burden of hidden shame and addictions was immense until it was finally lifted. I've accepted and overcome the shame, and also tried to be of service to those still suffering from it. I hope this book will help you do the same, by encouraging you to courageously explore your past and pain, knowing that by doing so, you can still bring honor to your heritage and yourself. Part 1. The Asian Immigrant. The Departure. I hate myself. This was one of my earliest thoughts as a Chinese boy in the United States. I wasn't white like those I saw on television. I wasn't black like those in my neighborhood. I was an Asian immigrant. I was an outsider, a foreigner, the other. It was 1976, and I was 4 years old. I hated looking different, speaking different, and having different customs and traditions from mainstream America. In Hong Kong, we were part of the Cantonese-speaking Chinese majority. I never felt different there. Hong Kong was not only home to my parents, but also my grandparents, great-grandparents, and their ancestors. Cantonese is the largest Chinese dialect in Hong Kong, Macau, and parts of southeastern China. Hong Kong was a British colony from 1842 until the handover back to China in 1997. For myself, this meant my early identity and roots were a confluence of British and Chinese. I can still recall the juxtaposition of British double-decker buses with traditional Chinese fishing junks along the Hong Kong harbor. Additionally, I have memories of our British passports to mark our distinction as Chinese with British citizenship. So even before setting foot in America, I was ethnically Chinese, but legally British. My young mind thought it was cool that I could be both Chinese and British. But this all changed when my parents decided to move the family to America. The first English words I heard were, "Ching chong chong." Not exactly the most welcoming reception. The first question hurled our way was whether we ate rats or dogs. I cringed and began distancing myself from my Chinese background. This cultural contempt and self-loathing became evident when my parents spoke to me and my brothers in Chinese, and I responded in English. I was embarrassed and ashamed of our heritage. I winced when they spoke Chinese in public. I wanted nothing to do with them in any setting, public or private. The shame of my native tongue couldn't have been more pronounced than when I was stuck in an enclosed city bus with my grandmother. During the weekends, while my parents worked, our grandmother watched over me and my brothers. She would ride the bus to Seattle's Chinatown to get groceries, and I'd come along just to break the monotony. My grandmother was also hard of hearing, so she shouted when speaking Chinese. It felt as if all eyes were on us, listening with suspicion to the most foreign of sounds to ever land on their ears. To ease the perceived tension, I did my best to respond in perfect English, thinking that by doing so, everyone would view me as a legitimate American. But it didn't matter if I could speak English without an accent, because there was no way I could get rid of my skin tone. It wasn't for a lack of effort, though. There were times when I took a bar of soap and scrubbed it hard against my flesh, hoping it would turn lighter. Obviously, that didn't help. I would have to live with my skin tone, a dead giveaway that no matter where I went, I could always be singled out, targeted, and labeled as the foreigner. The oldest son of the oldest son. The tension of growing up in a Western, individualistic society while living in a collectivist household was not lost on me. I was told time and again by my parents and other relatives that my life was to represent and honor my family and Chinese heritage. Individual pursuits and ideas were to be ignored, no matter what mainstream society was telling me. The weight of these expectations impacted me disproportionately, as I was the oldest son of the oldest son. My father is the oldest son of 7 children. My grandparents on my dad's side were in an arranged marriage, and it showed. Issues of domestic violence, gambling, and strife plagued their relationship and impacted the family. I'm told my grandfather had a gambling problem and eventually abandoned the family and moved from Hong Kong to Australia for a number of years, while my dad was tasked to work to help support the family. He dropped out of school by the time he was 13 and began working in Chinese restaurants. Along the way, he met a waitress who would become his wife, my mother. By the age of 30, my father had risen to the rank of chef and was making a name for himself. Yet, with 3 toddlers in tow, his individual aspirations were set aside for the desires of the family. My parents wanted a better opportunity for us. Neither of them had much of an education, as both came from poverty. The Pacific Northwest became their destination when a restaurant near Seattle wanted to sponsor my dad to work in the United States. Based on what they had heard about America, my parents felt it was in the collective best interest to move here. I say collective because not only did this mean our nuclear family could immigrate to the U.S., but so could my grandparents, aunts, and uncles due to immigration policies of that time. Thus, one fateful day in the summer of 1976, everyone on my dad's side of the family packed a suitcase and flew to Seattle to start life anew. From majority to minority. When my parents left Hong Kong to immigrate to the United States, it was for a better future for me and my 2 younger brothers. It was not an easy decision, as they were already in their early 30s, but they forged ahead, thinking their sacrifice would be worth it so we could receive an American education. My parents were part of the dominant culture in Hong Kong and viewed life through that prism of ethnic and cultural privilege. They were not only illiterate immigrants to a new land, but an ethnic minority popularized in Hollywood as strange, exotic, and foreign. My father worked as a chef for a Chinese restaurant in the suburbs outside of Seattle, and my mom was a waitress at a restaurant in Chinatown. Both worked long hours for low wages with no benefits. They didn't have medical or dental insurance. There was no paid sick leave or vacation. Beyond the cultural shock of adjusting to a new language and customs, they were stripped of the status of being part of the majority. Not only were they known as Chinese immigrants, they were a minority living in a black community. My family struggled to make sense of our place in this new land. The Seattle zip code of 98118, where we grew up, is now one of the most ethnically diverse in the United States, with speakers of 59 languages. However, when we arrived in the neighborhood, it was predominantly African American, with a growing population of Chinese, Japanese, and Filipinos. People may erroneously view culture shock as the simplistic process of assimilating into traditional, mainstream white society. For us, we had the additional layer of trying to navigate and integrate into an African American community. I point this out because growing up in a black neighborhood helped shape part of my identity. Hobbies, sports, music, and the culture of black America were adopted as my own. I view life through the prism of 3 lenses: mainstream white America, Asian, and black. When it comes to the perception of Asian identity, one big misconception people have is to clump us into a large, all-encompassing, monolithic group with scant understanding of the various ethnic, cultural, religious, and linguistic differences that set us apart. They also fail to recognize the different American cultural influences that impact our sense of self. Our identity is much more than our ethnicity. It includes the subcultures we experienced growing up. In addition, the values of Asian collectivism and groupthink that my parents and other relatives tried to impress on me and my brothers clashed with American ideals of independence. We were being taught at school to speak up, question authority, and think critically, while at home our parents stressed the importance of obedience, harmony, and never questioning authority figures like teachers, elders, and parents. How would all of this impact our sense of identity and shape how others viewed us or how we saw ourselves? Regardless of which type of community you grew up in, this belief that you are different from mainstream society becomes the first aspect of life many Asians encounter. The teasing, taunts, and racial slurs remind us that we are foreign, different, and at times considered un-American. The common caricatures associated with being Asian came my way starting in kindergarten. Questions like, "Where are you really from?" were commonplace. These questions, while sometimes benign and not meant to be cruel, nevertheless reaffirmed to my young mind that I was different and less than American. Something needed to change quickly if I was going to fit in. A nice American name. My Chinese first name, Fu Yuan, was another reminder of my foreignness. At school, I shuddered when teachers gave roll call and said my first name. I dreaded this ritual. I could hear kids snickering, so I feigned indifference, but the truth was, it hurt. Then, one fateful day, our parents decided to give us new names. They knew a white couple and asked them for 3 nice American names for me and my brothers. Without hesitation, the couple responded, "How about Sam, Ken, and Fred?" In one fell swoop, our Chinese names of Fu Yuan, Fu Quen, and Fu Yuang were replaced with Sam, Ken, and Fred. We didn't have any say in the matter, as our parents thought this would be the best way to help us assimilate. Despite the name change, teachers seemed to avoid my English name and gravitate toward my Chinese name, even though Sam was clearly written on the attendance sheets. They would fumble with the pronunciation of Fu Yuan, and I'd quickly interject and say, "It's Sam." This abandonment and embarrassment of my Chinese name is a sad aspect of assimilation. My mother also changed her name from Feng Ning to Fran. My father is the only one who kept his Chinese name, Wai Wan. This abandonment of our birth names to fit into mainstream society struck me as a paradox later in life, when I learned American expatriates who live overseas don't consider changing their names to assimilate. Changing our names was viewed favorably as a gesture of our willingness to adopt and adapt to American norms. Those who didn't would be viewed more harshly. Nevertheless, there were those who kept their ethnic names, but it came with the risk of being teased by other kids, of not getting called back for job interviews, and of feeling further alienated from mainstream society. Historically, being forced to change one's name is about power and control. Think about the slaves from Africa who were stripped of all their rights and their names. The TV miniseries Roots that aired in the 1970s is a reminder of how much a name meant when the African slave who went by Kunta Kinte refused to accept his slave name, Toby. He eventually does accept it, but fiercely preserves his real name by reminding his descendants of it, along with the associated meaning, heritage, and pride that came with it. Due to the oppression of slavery and Jim Crow laws, I can see why African Americans today take pride in their ethnic names. I appreciate their desire to find a means to reconnect with their heritage. When you have to disown a major aspect of your identity, such as your name, to fit into American society, it feels like you're cutting off a part of yourself. Why are we asked to sacrifice so much to be accepted in this country? A country that presumably extols the virtues of diversity, yet at the same time shuns those who appear or sound too ethnic. While my new name served its purpose in helping me assimilate, there's also a sense of cultural abandonment. I haven't thought about reclaiming my Chinese name, but I have renounced the need to cater to what mainstream America wants me to be. I can stand proud to be an Asian American, an American with a past that's different from the first European settlers. I pledge allegiance to my family name. In an Asian family, you learn honor early on, when your parents tell you about the meaning of your family name and its implications for your life. As a Louis, my honor, loyalty, and allegiance belonged to the family. What was important in life was not my individual self or accomplishments, Everything I did was to be geared toward bringing glory to the family name. Chinese names are written in three characters, with your family name first, not last. My Chinese name is Louis Fu Yuan. My father sat me down when I was 3 years old and helped me write my name. He circled the Louis character and emphasized that Fu Yuan doesn't matter much in life. What matters most is making sure you do good for the Louis name. Traditionally, when Chinese people greet each other, what they really want to know beyond the normal pleasantries is one's family name. While your first name is needed, what's vital is knowing your last name, so they can understand you within the larger and richer context of your family's heritage. Both parties respond with their family name. This allows them to get a mutual sense of who they are based on a family's lineage and reputation. As a Louis, my reputation today is still impacted by the actions of my deceased ancestors. Guns, crime, and violence. Around the same time that I adopted Sam as my new name, I became aware and sensitive to the crime around me. My mother always picked me up from school, but one day when I was in the first grade, an uncle did. I immediately sensed something was wrong. When I asked what happened, he told me someone tried to attack my mom at our family home. My heart stopped and time stood still. In age-appropriate language, my uncle conveyed that someone tried to rape my mom by posing as a city utility employee. My uncle shared that my mom was able to escape and run to the mini-mart at the top of our street and call for help. That day altered my understanding of safety. Our home was no longer safe. Our father worked and didn't return until we were already asleep. As the oldest male in the house, I took on the role of protector of the family to ensure this never happened again. When I was in elementary school, someone tried to break into our house, and my mother gathered me and my brothers in her bedroom, locked the doors, and shut off all the lights. I didn't understand the logic of staying silent while waiting for the police. In addition to calling the police, I called my best friend and told his family to come over. By the time police arrived, the robber had left, but the reality of living in an unsafe neighborhood was firmly established. I convinced an older friend to give me a BB gun for protection. I hid it under my bed and was hyper-vigilant of my surroundings. I would consistently peek out the windows of our backyard and survey the front yard for any possible signs of danger. As a reminder of the dangers around us, South Seattle was often in the local news because of shootings, robberies, and murders. Consequently, I became a light sleeper, ever on guard should I need to wake and fight off intruders. It was not lost on me that the homes in our neighborhood had windows with bars on them. People owned German shepherds and other loud, aggressive dogs to ward off burglars. Our neighborhood was highlighted in the news as a dangerous place. Due to the crime, our parents had negative views of African Americans. Additionally, there was a Chinese prejudice against black people, as the Chinese word hakwai, which means black ghost, was used when referring to African Americans. My parents would discourage me from hanging out with black friends and instead try to steer me toward other Asians. When I would use my money to buy my black friends candy or comic books, it made them even angrier, and they would tell me, "Black people can't be trusted." I want my Thanksgiving turkey. Because my parents were rooted in Asian worldviews about life and culture, they had no understanding of Western customs, holidays, or traditions. For example, on Thanksgiving, when I yearned to eat turkey with mashed potatoes, gravy, and cranberry sauce, my parents made us eat Peking duck instead. While there's no doubt the taste of Peking duck is succulent, my brothers and I clamored for years for a traditional Thanksgiving dinner. Yet year after year, my parents resisted, finally relenting when I was 18 years old, but by then, I didn't care anymore. Christmas, though, was a special holiday that I did care about, no matter how old I was. I yearned for the festive lights, wreaths, trees, and other symbols I saw in movies, on television, and at other friends' homes But my parents didn't see it as practical to spend money on these things, so I went my entire childhood without them. One year, a neighbor gave us an extra tree, but after experiencing the smell of pine needles in our home, the hope of more to come was quickly dashed when my mom said, "No more tree! Tree make too much mess!" When it came to gifts, I wanted real ones with some thought behind them. Yet, in our family's tradition, instead of gifts, our parents and extended family gave out Chinese red envelopes filled with money. To me, this felt like an easy way out. No thought was given to who I was as a person or to invest in gifts that could expand our horizons or nurture our interests. One uncle did break the mold by buying me various gifts over the years that I can still recall vividly. A juggling ball set, a beginner's stamp collector kit that made me curious about the wider world I was a part of, and a hacky sack, which I wasn't very good at. The point is, this uncle tried to find gifts that would spur us toward learning, creativity, and growth. Other areas of folklore that stood out included my parents' lack of understanding about the tooth fairy. I was in elementary school when I told my mom I was going to put my recently removed tooth under the pillow, and she just thought it was such an odd thing to do. When I shared gleefully about the tooth fairy coming overnight with money, she looked at me perplexed. Reality hit me the next day when I learned the hard way there was no tooth fairy. I was not born in the USA. Despite my Asian background, a part of me thought I was just as American as a white kid growing up in the suburbs. I played with Star Wars action figures, watched Bugs Bunny cartoons, and ate Frosted Flakes. Yet when Bruce Springsteen's hit song, Born in the USA, reverberated across the airwaves in the 80s, my heart sank. The song was about the difficulties of life in the U.S., and I saw it as another reminder that I wasn't truly American since I wasn't born here. It created a rift in my psyche that gnawed at my sense of identity. I'm not as American as my black friends. I'm definitely not as American as my white peers. This sense of patriotic alienation even extended to my Asian friends, as the majority of them could at least claim U.S. citizenship, as they were born in the country. Yet because I was born in Hong Kong and was an immigrant, I saw myself as a second-class citizen. The shame was noted on our formal identification cards. U.S. citizens have passports. As immigrants, we had what was known as green cards or resident alien cards, which I looked at with disgust. Why did the card have to label me an alien? I hated whenever we had to travel and show our proof of residency. In later years, the naming of this card was changed to permanent resident card, but by then the damage was done, and, once again, I saw myself as not being truly American. Rich kids eat at McDonald's. The shame and alienation of being poor added to my sense of separateness even from those around me. Nearly 80% of the students at my school qualified for free or reduced fee lunch. By the time I got to high school, the shame of being poor was unbearable as I saw the rich kids going to lunch at McDonald's or Jack in the Box. I was so ashamed of our socioeconomic background that I gave away my free lunch card to a friend's older brother. I preferred to buy lunch rather than get it free to distance myself from this daily reminder of my family's financial circumstances. You would think, since so many of the people around us qualified for free lunch, we were all in the same boat, but it wasn't the case. While most of us qualified for free lunch, I felt my family was worse off. The house my parents bought was not only the smallest on the block, it was the smallest among all of my friends' homes. The one-story house had two bedrooms and one bathroom and was approximately 500 square feet. We had no privacy, as my brothers and I slept in the same room. Our house was so small, friends wouldn't want to come over to play with us. Even playing outdoors highlighted our poverty. One of our favorite pastimes was riding our bikes through the neighborhood. The problem was, our parents could only afford one bike for the three of us. When we went anywhere with our friends, my middle brother, who was the strongest, would give me a ride for a portion of the way and drop me off. I would then run the remainder of the distance to wherever the kids were biking, while my
sample complete. Ready to continue?